The first time I went to India was in the fall of 1986. A few months later, I moved from Ananda Village to here, so it was a time of enormous transition. By that time in my life, I had traveled in Europe, but had never been to Asia or to anything. I'd never been to any place of what they called the third world, the developing world. This was 30 years ago, so vocabulary and realities were different. 30 years ago, in the history of India, is a really super long time. When we first started going there, this was the first pilgrimage that Ananda took to India. Now, of course, there have been many, many since. India was still closed to foreign corporations. They were still operating under the influence of Gandhi, who had wanted to essentially isolate India from many modern influences and keep the purity of it from an older time. Shortly after we started going there, India opened to foreign corporations, and in fact, Pepsi Cola had a launch in India at the Taj Mahal. It was a big event. And even from 1 year to the next, after that happened, in the city of Varanasi, Benares, the oldest inhabited city in the world, which was and still is an extremely chaotic and challenging place on the physical plane, and also just a thrilling place on the spiritual plane. It's one of the most confusing contrasts I'd ever experienced. But even in the course of 1 year, we came back the next year, and some of the little boats that you could take out on the Ganges had advertisements for Coca-Cola on them. And I remember standing there and looking at that and thinking, well, you know, there's no way anything ever stays the same. Swami Kriyananda's response when he moved to India in 2003, and he had lived there from 1958 to 62, which was a long time ago. And it was really a different country. And when he went back in 2003, so much had shifted. And naively, one's expectation was that he would be nostalgic for the past or something like that. But he said, no, India, as he put it, is much too important to the future of the planet for it to be held back. It has to take its place in the modern world. And he said, excessive materialism and all that comes with it, he said, is just a necessary stage that the country has to pass through, he said, but its essential spiritual qualities will rescue it from the worst excesses. Well, describing all of that, I'm going to talk about something else. It's not really about India, although it was all prompted by my experiences there. Growing up in America, having traveled only a little bit in Europe, I just wasn't prepared for a culture that was so entirely different. Just start with the word overpopulation, which is a word that you can kind of hear and hear it talked about, but you don't really understand what overpopulation is until you're on the Howrah Bridge in Calcutta trying to get from point A to point B, and being on a big bus and having it so jammed that you have like a tolerance, a space of about 4 inches just in all directions that you can see. And every possible form of locomotion is present, motorcycles, bicycles, on foot, cars, you know, carts, animal carts, big buses, old cars, new cars, just unbelievable. When Hare Krishna Ghosh, Yogananda's nephew, and his wife came to America for the first time. And they were very eager to see all the sights like any tourist would. And we took them to see the Golden Gate Bridge. We drove across the bridge and went to the view spot up in on the Marin side up there. And we're looking out at the bridge. And it was actually close to rush hour. And the cars were moving along. And Hare Krishna was so bewildered. And he turned to us and he said, where are the people? And we said, well, they're all inside the cars. And it just, he couldn't figure it out, because rush hour in India meant that it was shoulder to shoulder. And lots of it was just people just moving from here to there. So seeing all of that, just looking out the window of the bus, and we moved in a very insulated manner, in and out of first-class hotels and in and out of air-conditioned buses. We didn't have the capacity, really, to move through India in any other way. But looking out the window, just looking at what I was looking at, I realized how every problem in the world can be solved. I mean, even now, we all know we have no lack of resources, natural or man-made. We have no lack of creativity, technology, energy. It's that people don't want to solve the problems. And people don't want to solve the problems. It's not merely that there's one class oppressing another, although there is. You know, that's also there. One group takes for itself. But everybody has a certain reality that they're having to live through. And there's nothing that can hurry that. And that's not anything that can be dictated from the outside. I was just remembering an amusing incident in the crowds. We stayed in the Grand Hotel in Calcutta, for those of you who have ever been there, because so many people have now traveled to India. The Grand Hotel later fixed its driveway so that you come all the way in and you exit on a protected courtyard. But in the years when we went, you just got off on the street and you had to cross a very wide portico. And all of the, you know, the best beggars in Calcutta knew that they were meeting the richest tourists at the Grand Hotel, so that it was just a mob scene. We were just totally mobbed by beggars, professional beggars, who were trying to get money from us. And we had this gentleman with us. It's John Wright's father, those of you who know John Wright, Clarence. Clarence and his mother, Norma, they've both passed away. They were elderly then, Clarence older than Norma. And Clarence seemed a little vague. But Clarence had been a soldier. He was Colonel Wright. And he had a lot more going for him than showed right at that point. And I remember someone foolishly was going to give someone money, and to do so they pulled out their whole wallet and opened their wallet, which is not a smart thing to do. And some other person put the hand on the wallet, and just as soon as they put the hand on the wallet, Clarence grabbed him at some point that he knew from hand-to-hand combat in which he was trained to paralyze the man's hand. So it was kind of a trio, the wallet, the thief, and then Clarence with very thick glasses just kind of blinking at the man like this, and sort of in his way said, I wouldn't recommend doing that, you know, just holding onto this guy's hand like this. And I thought, my gosh, what a clash of universes. You know, just all these different karmas is the only word for it. You know, this unfortunate thief had to try to steal the wallet when he was inches away from Clarence Wright, who looked like a pushover, but wasn't, you know. And there's just all these different forces. We stayed at that time when India is so different now, but I remember that first stay at the Calcutta Hotel, the Grand Hotel. And we were on the fifth or sixth floor, and you'd look down on these sidewalks. And we were there for several days, and there were people who lived there. We were staying in the rooms, they were living in their spaces. And you could watch family life just carrying itself out there. And there was this other factor that I observed, and we led these pilgrimages to India about 12 times. And at that time, it was the first time most Ananda people were going to India. So it was a wholly different thing. And everybody had to go through some kind of relationship to what we were seeing. You know, so much poverty, so much chaos compared to our way of thinking. And people had very, very different reactions, especially to suffering, what was perceived as suffering, which was genuine in many cases. But people had very different reactions to it. And pretty much right at the beginning, I began to figure out what was happening. All of us in our lives suffer. And that is what drives us to God. This was, is it Krishna's words to Arjuna? Get away from my ocean of suffering. That this world of duality sooner or later breaks our heart. And when your heart is broken enough times, you begin to ask the question, is there an alternative? When Master came to America, he brought with him a little booklet called The Science of Religion. And it had very, very simple idea in it, which was really the foundation of everything that Master taught. It was his way of taking, you know, the Sanatana Dharma of ancient India and making it practical. And it was very simple. Everyone in the world is motivated by two things, to experience joy and to escape suffering. And absolutely everything we do is very simply designed to accomplish one or the other of those objectives according to what we think is going to work for us right at this time. And all of us, therefore, are motivated by that lack of perfect fulfillment and that feeling of pain in our own hearts. None of us enjoy that feeling of pain. It's there it is. And that's why we're pushed. If we didn't suffer, we wouldn't be pushed. If we were content, we wouldn't be pushed. Even people who, you know, we think might be suffering don't feel it in such a way that they care enough to look for an alternative. But because our soul is never satisfied until we get back to divine bliss, something keeps pushing us. And there's this wisdom of the universe that is acting through us individually, that is the wisdom of our own soul and the wisdom of our divine mother. And she is taking us through this project. Just like human parents take their little child through a certain project. And there's certain things that the child has to do that the child doesn't understand and doesn't want to do. Why do I have to go to school? I remember a little girl at Ananda Village whose mother would tell her lots of stories about saints. And of course you tell children stories about children because it inspires them. And there's some wonderful stories about young children who had visions of the Virgin Mary. You know, the Fatima children and in Lourdes, they're just beautiful stories, and others as well. So this little girl announced to her mother when she was about 7 that she wasn't going to go to school anymore because she didn't see any need for school, because her ambition in life was to have a vision of the Virgin Mary, and she saw that the most likely people to have that were sheep herders. Because so many of these little children were out tending their sheep when the Virgin appeared to them. So she was going to be a sheep herder, and she saw no further need for school. You know, they sort of worked it out and got her to go on continuously. But nonetheless, children, and often it's more painful. Why do I have to study? Why do I have to practice my musical instrument? Why does Daddy have to go to work every day? Why is Mommy sick? You know, things happen that we don't want to have happen. And Divine Mother is pushing us through. Human parents take their children through. Divine Mother pushes us through. So we go to a place, like we did in the late 80s, to India, where a form of suffering, which is in the form of poverty and sickness especially, and lack of physical comfort especially, which to Americans looms very, very large in our little mental sky. You know, that sort of thing looks really big to us. And people would panic. Not everyone, but some people would panic. And it was so interesting to me because it was hard for me to predict sometimes who would react. And the thread that I finally found and found in myself was very simply this. If one has accepted in oneself that suffering is a necessary stage on the path to freedom, then one could observe it in others with equanimity. But if there was still fear about the necessity for suffering as a path to freedom, then to see it so all-pervasively literally put people into a panic. Because how can I look at this and believe that Divine Mother is in charge? And I didn't have any answers either, and by no means was I immune, you know, to the anxiety that everyone around me was feeling. I have enough anxiety in myself that it was not hard. But also, what it becomes is it becomes this extraordinary challenge to your faith, to one's faith. Because if the law of karma is ever true, it has to always be true. It can't be possible that some souls are outside of the necessary process for their freedom. And no matter how awful people may be, because the other side of it is not merely those who appear to be the innocent victims of suffering, but there's the callous disregard for the welfare of others, which is all pervasive on this planet. You know, there are certain principles of the spiritual path, as I've learned it from Swami Kriyananda over these years, that to my mind are like pillars for, I would call it almost sanity in this world, but certainly for stability on this spiritual path. One of them is the law of karma, and the other, oddly enough, is the yugas. And the yugas talk about why some planets are more terrible than other planets, and the fact that there are many planets to choose from, and that the planetary conditions are merely a passing parade, that through, and I just recommend Purushottama and David Steinmetz's book about the yugas. I won't try to explain it, but it says very simply that planets go through orbits over long periods of time, and we're closer and farther away from the energy center of the galaxy in which we operate. And when we're farther away, we become lower in consciousness, and when we're closer, we become more elevated. But we don't belong to a planet. We get to come to whatever planet is going to cause us enough suffering or give us enough joy to push us into the next thing that we have to learn. And the next thing that we have to learn is very simple, which is we must become God realized. And to be God realized is to understand this world and to see it only as God sees it. I had the experience, as you all know, of living many, many years with Swami Kriyananda, observing him, experiencing his friendship, his genius, in so many different ways. But the single, dare I say it, and perhaps I will today, the single most astonishing fact of Swamiji was his complete acceptance of other people's realities. And it was a very interesting blend, because in his role, in the reason that he incarnated to help people spiritually. I was reading some notes of conversations with him about, you know, if people weren't interested in what he had to offer them spiritually, he basically had there was no basis for a relationship. And no matter how much he might like someone or want to help them, if they didn't understand what he had to give them spiritually, he had no other reason for living, and certainly no other reason for relating to people. So his constant force from the moment I first met him was he constantly projected this, what I can only call an upward moving thrust of energy. And an upward moving thrust of energy that was magnetic rather than coercive. Because you can push people. You must get it done. You know, I'll give you a bad performance review and then you will do better. Sometimes in talking to people about our school and the principles of our school, sometimes parents distrust that we can actually be educating children because the children are enjoying themselves so much. If they're not scared and stressed, how can they be learning? I have turned the question back and said to the adult parents, if you're scared and uncomfortable, do you do your best work? You know, how open to you are learning when you feel like the slightest misstep on your part is going to bring an anvil of a disapproval down on your head? Another mother was saying to me recently, she loves our school and her child, but he goes to some math tutorial or something, but she has she wasn't sure whether she really wanted to send him there because the energy was so uncongenial compared to Ananda. But then she sort of tries to say, well, he's going to have to face that sometime in his life. I said, yeah, it's like I just planted an apple tree outside and I'm going to say someday there's going to be a drought, so I'm not going to water you now, you know, so someday you can face the drought. We all know, you know, take care of it, make it strong, let its roots go deep, and then when the storm comes, it'll be ready. But for some reason, we get very confused. So coercive people, scaring them into behaving, is not the same. So what Swami always radiated was magnetism, which is an awakening flow of energy that caused everyone in his aura, even now, I mean, being off the planet is no obstacle, to just kind of stand up straighter, smile a little brighter, and feel hope in your heart. Just, there's hope for me too. You know, there's just hope for me. I can do it. And I want to do it because this is my escape. This is my escape from suffering. This is my entrance into joy. But the other reason why magnetism rather than coercion is the only way is that we simply can't move any faster than we can move. And no amount of impatience, no amount of distrust of one another, no amount of disrespect, nothing. It won't make a whit of difference. Each of us unravels that karmic knot as fast as we can. I was working this last month on the costumes with the children for the school play, and many of them had little pajama-style pants because we were in Indian South. I'm pulling at the elastic on the waist of my pants. And I try to change every drawstring into elastic because the problem with drawstrings is twofold. One, they exit from the pants at a very inconvenient moment, and then the child is really in trouble, or else they get into a knot, you know, and there's the poor kid either can't tighten them or can't get out of them, and they're just in this knot. And I've spent many a time with these tiny little strings trying to pull these things apart, and the image is just too vivid. You know, isn't that how it feels sometimes, that somehow we've just taken some little experience and we've literally tied ourselves in knots over it. And no matter how hard we try, we just have to keep pulling. And oh, just when you can just go along and go, just cut it off like that. It's just such freedom, isn't it? I mean, that's where we are, all of us. You know, we've chosen a planet that could be more supportive. It must have seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, that we just don't merit a better planet. But these kinds of planets are good for us because they're a very strong incentive. They don't allow us to just settle down and be happy. I said to Swamiji once, in the middle of his life, just jokingly, I said, sir, next time you incarnate and we all have to come with you, I said, why don't we wait for a higher yuga? You know, because we were particularly displeased about something on the planet. His first response was, I don't ever intend to come back. He modified that toward the end of his life and sort of sighed and said, well, I know myself, is how he put it. He said, I know I'm going to want to help you all. He said, I'm going to come back to help you. I said, that's the only reason you came this time, isn't it? And then he sort of looked very modest. He said, well, yes, sort of like that. But he said, even though in Satya Yuga, the highest age, he said, it's still the material plane. But he said something so sweet. He said, but people like us are in charge. I said, so the whole world is one great big Ananda. He said, yes. He said, but it still doesn't satisfy. Because still there are all those nuances. There's these little nuances, and this is what our reading is talking about. The little bits in our consciousness. Maybe we've trained ourselves not to murder anymore, but the impulse is still there. And who suffers most from those negative vibrations? Not only, of course, when we put them out, we set up the magnetism to bring them back to us, and they're really no fun coming back, but also when we squeeze our hearts with that kind of disrespect and that kind of impatience, and that force, you project it out, but it's diluted by the time it comes out, where it's in its pure form is right here. And then when we're alone with ourselves, whether trying to meditate or trying to sleep or trying to walk in the woods, and all of those dissonances. And there's no escape from that. There's absolutely no escape from that. The inescapability of individual consciousness, the anguishing monotony of it. But if we suffer enough, and we may suffer hugely externally, but eventually the worst suffering, it all comes back to this dissonance within ourselves. And it's just not worth it. That's what I watched in Swamiji. He was so kind. He was so conscious. He was so completely aware of the realities of everyone's consciousness. He said once, he said, just a glance into a person's eyes, he said, and I can see it all. He didn't talk like that very often, but every so often he would reveal. He knew more than anyone, but he was there to help. And he knew even the slightest impatience on his part, what to speak of judgment, what to speak of lack of compassion or support. It, above all, who did it hurt? It hurt him. And he'd suffered enough. You know? So it's really our question, when have we suffered enough? When will we finally know that being godlike, being Divine Mother's love to ourselves and to each other, is the only choice? Because all other choice is misery. You know, that's a very tight knot. But if you keep pulling at it, and with God's grace, you know, we will be free. God bless you.